Aloha, mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Monday, July 22nd. I'm Russell Subiono, sitting in for Catherine Cruz. News of President Biden withdrawing from the 2024 presidential race is starting to sink in. How did our delegation on Capitol Hill react? We'll take a closer look. The new proposed management plan for Keoho Bay on Hawaii Island is creating waves in the community. We'll hear from Kamehameha Schools, who owns much of the land there and hopes to upgrade the public's experience. We'll also hear from an environmental attorney who has reservations about the proposal. Plus, we'll explore the history of Puerto Rican music in Hawaii, the origins of that kachikachi sound and the people who brought it to our islands. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Russell Subiono, in for Catherine Cruz. President Biden and the Democratic Party are looking ahead to a very different election season following his announcement yesterday that he's dropping out of the presidential race. He's endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to be his successor to lead the Democratic presidential ticket. What about here in Hawaii? HPR's news director Bill Dorman has been following that and joins us with more. And Bill, so far the support for Harris has been strong, but not unanimous.
You know, by the numbers, Hawaii is such an overwhelmingly blue state packed with Democrats that that's reflected in the state legislature, governor's mansion, the delegation on Capitol Hill. But that doesn't mean that it always moves in lockstep like some monolithic machine. And Kamala Harris is an interesting example of that. You know, Ed Case has not rushed to endorse her. It's not a shock in some ways. He's among the Democrats who are holding back for the moment. And that number still includes former President Obama, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Notably, this morning, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi endorsed Harris. But others are referring to Harris's statement about her wanting to earn the nomination, and it seems like Congressman Case falls into that category. He said in a statement yesterday, "The path ahead is difficult, and I will take some limited time to discuss with my constituents and colleagues the best way forward on a Democratic nominee." And the starting point really on all of this, just the extraordinary nature of what's going on, the speed with which all of this moved yesterday, and not to make too much of a deal of it, but just in terms of looking at the politics, interesting to see how the statements of support came out yesterday. Senator Mazie Hirono is out with a reaction very quickly, not only thanking President Biden for his accomplishments and work, but also endorsing Harris as the next nominee. Congressman Jill Takuda also included an endorsement of Harris as part of her initial statement, along with thanks to President Biden. But Senator Brian Schatz, Governor Josh Green, both out with immediate praise for President Biden and then a follow-up statement adding their endorsement of Harris.
And Senator Brian Schatz posted a picture of himself climbing a coconut tree on social media. What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, thanks to our producer, Maddie Bender, for adding a little contextual knowledge to this, dragging down some details. How the coconut tree has come to be associated with Kamala Harris. This all started, apparently, with a speech that Harris gave at the White House in May 2023. This was at an event about opportunities for Hispanic Americans and a White House initiative. And she spoke about it while this initiative was aimed at young people. But it also needed to include a broader context because, as she said, none of us live in a silo. And she referred to something her mother used to say, which started off with, "I don't know what's wrong with you young people."
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you.
You know, that idea, you exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you. So that was what launched Coconut Tree as a meme, as a reminder that you're part of something broader, not just yourself, and there are things that came before you. And something Senator Schatz latched onto as part of his support. So that picture of him up the tree as a caption saying simply, "Madam Vice President, we're ready to help."
Well, thanks for that explanation, because when I first saw it this morning, I had no idea what it meant. So that's so helpful. So what comes next for Hawaii's congressional delegation and everyone else?
Yeah, right now, really, it's all about the delegates. Delegates to the convention. The convention itself, August 19th to the 22nd in Chicago, of course, Harris getting their support. That's what this is about. You'll hear a lot on national news about the mechanics of how this works, but here are some highlights. So President Biden stepping out of the race, that releases his delegates, but it's not like he can transfer them. These are individual decisions of the delegates. It's also wrapped up with the party organization. Yesterday, all the state Democratic Party committees announced support for Harris, including Hawaii Democratic Party Chair Derek Turbin. But that's not binding on delegates. And from a national perspective, the Democratic National Committee would prefer to wrap this up sooner rather than later. They're working on getting a virtual roll call of delegates in the first week of August. You may recall this was something the Biden campaign wanted to do earlier. It got delayed in part because of such opposition from Capitol Hill Democrats. But the next couple of days or so, it's about lobbying, messaging, consolidating support, and moving Harris to be the nominee clearly, or agreeing on a process that gets to a final decision.
And Governor Josh Green apparently has a role in fundraising. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so the governor had planned to hold a fundraiser at Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts for President Biden, and that was scheduled for a week from today. And he was going to host this at the home of a family friend, and you may be thinking, what, Martha's Vineyard? What is that about? Well, here's some local presidential trivia you may not have known. Apparently, Jamie Green, the first lady, her uncle was a roommate of President Biden when he was in college at the University of Delaware. Not a lot of details there, but this fundraiser itself was to be co-hosted by David Letterman. Governor said that the plans are to move ahead with this, raise the money for the vice president, but the logistics on this still being worked out.
Okay. Well, it's interesting news. I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going to happen next, but be interesting to see how things turn out. This has never happened before, right?
Unprecedented on so many levels. And a couple of things for this week to watch for. Certainly, President Biden says that he'll address the nation. Can expect, I would think, an Oval Office address. That could come as soon as tomorrow, some are saying. But we'll see with that what happens. Likely evening time, East Coast time. We'll have it live on HPR.
Right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Bill. I know you started work on this yesterday, so thanks so much for working on this on the weekend. Appreciate your time.
You bet. Thanks.
We've been talking to HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, about the Hawaii delegation's reaction to President Biden withdrawing from the 2024 presidential race. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. On a summer's day like today, this backyard quiz is a cold, sweet treat. We're talking about Shave Ice, of course. It's a favorite among locals and visitors. A popular spot like Matsumoto's in Haleiwa sells more than 1,000 Shave Ice a day. Wow. Shave Ice desserts are found all over the world, with different regions putting their own twist on the icy base and sweetened topping. In Mexico, raspas comes in flavors like tamarind and chamoy, while in Turkey, Their iced dessert is called BGBG because that's the sound that starch makes when it's squeezed between your fingers into the dessert. Hawaii Shave Ice was born during the plantation era when immigrants from Okinawa and other parts of Japan sold the Japanese version of the icy dessert to laborers. You can trace the roots of the Japanese version of this treat all the way back to the 11th century AD. In a volume called The Pillow Book, a Japanese lady-in-waiting described a dessert made by scraping ice into a metal bowl and adding kudzu plant. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know, what was the name of this Japanese what was the name of this Japanese concoction that led to Hawaii's shave ice? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
The Great Salt Lake is drying up and could disappear in just 5 years.
When you look at the state of saline lakes around the world, the percentage of what lakes have survived is zero. Zero. So we have a monumental task before us.
It's central to environmental and economic life in Utah, and it holds great religious significance, too. Can the Great Salt Lake be saved? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years of preparing Hawaii's future business leaders for global opportunities. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Keaho Bay is a historic site tucked away in the southern part of the Kona District on Hawaii Island. It's best known as the birth site of Kawikeaouli, who later became King Kamehameha III. Today it's a cultural site that's open to the public and maintained by the Daughters of Hawaii. The bay is also a popular recreation site for the community. Many use the small boat ramp to access the ocean. It's also home to commercial tour companies who share use of that ramp. Much of the land at the bay is owned by Kamehameha Schools, which has proposed a new management plan for the area at the direction of Hawaii County. I recently talked to Marissa Harmon, the Director of Planning and Development for Kamehameha Schools, about the plan.
Main highlights of our new plan is to focus on the Aina Hanau, the birth site area for Kawikeaouli, Kamehameha III. So KS is a major landowner of about 54 acres at the bay, which includes the birth site, as well as many areas that are accessed by the community and others at the bay. And so what ends up is we have this high congestion area, some conflict of uses, and it really is impacting our cultural sites and our natural resources there. So we started out focusing on Aina Hanau and how can we shift the activity and the use to be more culturally mindful. And so a big part of that would be relocating our commercial operators that are currently at the bayfront across of the birth site and creating a new commercial center, a small-scale commercial center nearby for those commercial operators to relocate to. Then we can repurpose those buildings at Aina Hanau to have a cultural and educational component that ties in with the cultural landscape right there at the bay, including the birth site, including a restoration of Ho'okuku Pond, also referred to as Kuhalalua Pond, enhancing the access and stewardship of Mo'ikeha Cave nearby, creating space for ceremony and educational uses around the birth site and the bayfront. So then we move to the commercial space that we'll be creating on the corner intersection on the way to the Outrigger Sheraton there on an already zoned resort piece. And that will allow us to facilitate the switch in use of the existing buildings at the bayfront. It will have improved parking and availability of parking so that folks accessing the bay can park once and walk to various sites at Keoho Bay, helping to reduce kind of the traffic congestion. The people who are always searching for parking and constantly circulating, improve the experience for pedestrians, and improve access to our cultural and natural landscape there. And overall, the goal of the plan really is to support enhancement to our aina, to our culture and our community. And so one of the ways we also want to utilize this project is to continue to further our educational mission by the uses at the Bay, but also to further our broader educational mission, including financial support to our other programs. And so the commercial space, as well as the proposed low impact lodging on the bluff above the bayfront on an already zoned resort piece, will allow us to contribute to our overall educational mission by generating funds in what we see as an appropriate use of those lands as designated by the county general plan. Also as a low impact approach, including the sustainable environmental design of those buildings for the low impact lodging and the connection to our surrounding lands through a regenerative model experience. And that regenerative experience we really see being successful with community involvement, ensuring that the regenerative experience, the low impact lodging, benefits our Kupa Aina, those born of the land, our Kama Aina who live there now, as well as enhancing GSS stewardship in the area. The sustainable design elements, the opportunities for those who utilize the lodging to authentically learn and experience our culture and connection with Aina by also connecting to our other lands and opportunities in the area, connecting to our cultural heritage center down at the Bay, and really having an opportunity to learn about Kaui Keoli, to learn about our Ali'i like Pauahi, and contribute to this regenerative experience at Keoho Bay. Another piece of the regenerative experience is being able to connect locally sourced food grown on Kamehameha School's farms, around 700 in the North and South Kona area, to this site, to our vendors, to our operators who will be here at Keoho Bay. Some of our tenants are already doing that and incorporating that into their experiences for their guests at Keoho Bay. So we're really excited to see our local businesses taking on that regenerative mindset as well.
Whenever there is a proposal for planned development, people are always concerned about impact. And you did use the term low impact when you were describing some of the proposed development there. Can you expand on that? What does low impact mean in terms of how this development will impact the Bay?
The reason for this comprehensive plan really is because the County of Hawaii also asked us to provide them with a comprehensive plan for the long term for Keoho Bay. So that was one of the justifications for us moving forward with this plan, because they too see the need for better facilitation of land use and flow through Keoho Bay. So a big component of that also, which I didn't have the chance to mention earlier, is the reestablishment of the old Kona Road that will push much of the traffic flow off and back from the bayfront. It will also provide a north to south connection across the bay that doesn't exist at this time. And to the point of low impact, so our existing parking areas will be enhanced for better efficiency of parking within the same footprint that we see on the north end of the bay. Low impact at the commercial space in terms of one-story low-rise buildings that are walkable, approachable, native vegetation replacing invasive and non-native vegetation at this time, which enhances permeability of water being received at the site. Low impact on the lodging end by building on post and pier, individual buildings versus massive structures, so that we're having minimal impact to grading on site and creating management of runoff that currently is unmanaged on vacant land. So those are some of the elements we see as being low impact, including looking at the potential density of the zoning of the existing resort site, around 745 units. We are approaching it low impact and requesting approval for 150 maximum units. So that's another way We look at the project being low impact, looking to optimize land use there versus maximizing it.
And you said earlier that the county instructed KS to create a management plan for the area. How long has KS been working on this plan?
So actually, we began work in recent times on Keohope after the 2011 tsunami. And in those discussions with the county for some of those emergency repairs is when they instructed us to work on a comprehensive long-term plan for Keohope while they approved the interim emergency repairs. And so we embarked on this actual management plan work beginning in 2016. So we are coming up on 8 years of working through this plan with our key stakeholders. We're rounding up on almost 100 meetings with individuals and groups and agencies throughout those 8 years, over half of those meetings taking place in the last 2 years. So we're really proud of our engagement and our outreach with our community, the reconnection we've been able to make with our Kupuna and lineal descendants through this 8-year process, and rebuilding those relationships with our Kupa'aina from the area as we talk to them about Keohope Bay, the hopes, the dreams, and how we can problem solve, you know, a bay that has really not changed that much in decades, but use has continued by the general public and folks visiting our island.
In the planning process, as you spoke to the community and other stakeholders, you know, have a connection to the bay, what were some of the things that they wanted or that they felt that the bay needed that KS was able to incorporate into the proposed plan?
Sure. Well, your question initially makes me think to our Kupuna stakeholder group. And one of the things they reminded us of and asked us again recently in our summer meetings was to remember that Keohope Bay is part of a larger landscape and connected to the work that KS has done at Kahalu'u. At Kahalu'u Makai, our new educational center there. And so our kupuna and our engagement with the Daughters of Hawaii, that really leads a lot of our guidance that we take in terms of input from our community. They're our first and foremost groups that we always engage with. We want to be sure that we're on the same page with our kupuna and lineal descendants and the daughters who care for and steward the birth site. And so a big ask of theirs, first and foremost, is to ensure we honor our ali'i, we honor our kupuna, and we honor our future generations by the work that we do here. And so that's a lot of what you see proposed at Aina Hanau, is that shift away from the commercial immediate use near the birth site to a shift in cultural and educational use. We have had folks ask us to also create programs on the marine side in the ocean, looking at restoration of coral. And so this plan is a land use plan. It really focuses us within our ownership land side, but we have been open to discussing and developing partnerships through our community education programs on how we could expand connection to ocean, especially once we have our educational and cultural heritage center open and actively being used by community and students.
Anytime there's a proposed development in our islands, the public does tend to, you know, have a multitude of opinions. You know, there's a whole spectrum of opinions that people have. Are there any misconceptions about the proposal or the draft EIS that you feel should be cleared up for the public?
Absolutely. With every project, there is the opportunity for misinformation to be shared out. And this is one of the reasons we've had almost 100 meetings, because anytime someone inquires with us, hey, I heard this about your project, is that true? I always offer to sit down with them, walk them through the whole project, and offer one-on-one time to answer questions and concerns. One of the biggest pieces of misinformation that has come out about our project is regarding the low-impact lodging site. So I just want to be clear, it is already zoned resort. It is designated as part of the resort nodes the county has looked at. They are guiding folks. If there's going to be resort activity, it should be within these specific areas the county has already designated. To that end, we've had folks ask us, why aren't you doing affordable housing on that bluff above the bay? Why do you have to do another lodging experience? And there's a couple answers to that. We did, after our environmental impact statement preparation notice, look into the feasibility of housing at a site that's actually zoned resort. Due to the topography of this site, the elevation changes from 10 feet up to 110 feet within that short run. The amount of infrastructure that would need to be developed for a single or multifamily housing project would leave such a project at a price point that wouldn't meet an accessible housing mark. But I think one of the beauties of us being a large landowner in Hawaii with land holdings across the state in multiple zoning districts, we do have sites that are appropriate for housing and within the near jurisdiction of this Kilho site that we are working on through other projects and even with other agencies. So I just want it to be clear, housing is absolutely a goal of our organization that we are working on actively in areas that are appropriately designated for housing. So I did want to make that point, so I appreciate the opportunity. And also, we will be connecting to the existing wastewater system that has excess capacity to take on this project. So I know that's also been a concern that has come up, is what's happening to wastewater to keep our nearshore waters pristine. So it will be managed through a treatment plant. You know, when we think of our great Ali'i, Kaui Keoli, who was born here, and our need to continue to honor him and also honor Pauahi's wishes to continue to educate our Lahui for generations to come. That is core to this plan and to us feeling good and confident about this plan that we are honoring our Ali'i and our Kupuna as we go forward and providing opportunities for our Keiki and our Haumana to come.
Marissa Harmon, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate being able to talk to you.
Mahalo nui, Russell.
That was Kamehameha Schools Director of Planning and Development, Marissa Harmon, talking about the proposed Keaho Bay Management Plan. Coming up after the break, an environmental attorney shares his thoughts on the draft EIS for the management plan.
Support for HPR comes from the Chamber of Sustainable Commerce with a Wailea Pauhana Mixer this afternoon at Wailea Contemporary Gallery in Wailea Village. Registration at chamberofsustainablecommerce.org.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with David Leitch about performing and directing dangerous and wild movie stunts. He was a stunt double for Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, and Keanu Reeves. Leitch produced and directed the new action comedy film The Fall Guy, starring Ryan Gosling as a stuntman who has to perform stunts in his real life in order to save his life. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho Grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
Kamehameha School's proposed Keaho Bay management plan includes many upgrades and aims to reorganize some of the bay's activity. But as with any proposed development or change in our islands, there's also those who disagree with what's proposed. Jeff Caulfield is a part-time resident of Keaho Bay and a short-term vacation rental owner in the Kona area. He's also a retired environmental attorney who has years of experience helping to prepare environmental impact statements and litigating cases involving them. I talked to him recently about the issues he has with the proposed plan's draft EIS.
I think the EIS appears to be written to minimize the impacts by not really giving the public the straight story. Things like claiming it's going to reduce congestion when you're talking about adding 150 bedrooms and commercial kiosks and commercial buildings and restaurants and everything else in the bay. I mean, that's not, adding people doesn't make sense to claim then that's going to reduce congestion. If anything, it's going to worsen, and I think in many instances really alter the characteristic of the bay because it's a pretty quiet, magical place most of the time. And so the EIS really needs to better address and inform the public as to what the real impacts are going to be, you know, how many, you know, visitors are going to come to the cultural center, what the expected increase in usage from the commercial kiosks and kayak rentals, and also how many, you know, additional vehicle trips are going to be around the bay. The EIS doesn't really do that, in my opinion.
I imagine that there are some points in the EIS that you take issue with, maybe even more than one point. What are one or two of the biggest points or topics in the EIS that you do take issue with?
The two top points probably are the real traffic and just congestion impacts of the project. I don't think the EIS has any real studies of what the existing uses are and traffic as it stands now, and then what the additional traffic is going to be, and with projections, which is what they're supposed to have. So that's one of the big things. I think it's going to cause a lot of congestion around the bay, which is going to impact, you know, not only just the public's access to the bay, but also the health of the bay itself. Secondly, they are talking about removing many acres of forest above the bay, which, and replace it with buildings and homes and streets and parking lots, etc., which all of those things are pollutant sources that can enter the bay. And there's not really a discussion of the impact of the removal of the forest and essentially what is going to be created from the homes and the roads, et cetera, by way of potential contaminants entering the bay and what the impacts on the bay would be from that. And that's something that I think I'd like to see a discussion of, because the EIR just kind of glosses over that issue without really going into detail about, you know, okay, so we have multi-inch rainfall event that's occasioned from either like a Kona low, or, you know, we get hit by the remnants of hurricanes. So we get 4 inches of rain within a 2-day period. How much stuff is going to get carried in the bay because there's no longer the forest there to soak up the water and soak up the stuff? Instead, you're going to have a lot more runoff because you're talking about roads and houses and you name it. And how is that going to impact the bay by carrying toxic pollutants from roads and houses and lawns and you name it that's built into the bay? How much is that going to impact the bay from the standpoint of saltwater, salinity balance, those things?
I know that you're a part-time resident of Calhoun Bay. What's your sense as to the community's feelings about the proposed management plan?
I don't think anybody, any of the users of the bay, think it's a good idea. I mean, I've not talked to anybody that feels like anything in this project is going to be a benefit to the community. If anything, for example, you've got a pretty large volleyball community that uses the court down there, where there's probably several hundred people or more that use the court in any given month between families and kids and adults and you name it. For example, that community is very upset because the court that's been there for 35 plus years is being removed. And so that the access to the community and, you know, families would come down every weekend and barbecue, and the whole family goes to play volleyball on the court. And there's only 3 total courts in all of Kona that are sand volleyball courts. And so you're taking away a third of the courts, and the other 2 courts are already extremely congested and overused. And so there's that community. I know some of the fishing community guys have expressed concerns because if you start adding kayak and sup rentals to the bay, you know, they go in and out through essentially the channel of the bay to and from the docks, etc. And the tourists don't know that, hey, you can't be out there on a paddleboard or kayak in the middle of the lane with the fishing boats and, you know, the fair winds and other big boats are going up and down. And so you're increasing the potential hazard to, you know, people getting hit by boats, you name it, because there's not that many people necessarily out on kayaks and not that many tourists out there on any given day. It's not an issue, but all of a sudden, if you add a huge kayak and paddleboard rental center as part of the deal, the impacts of the fishermen are not going to be good.
Is there anything in the plan that you feel is worth keeping? the cultural aspect seems like it would be a good thing for the community. The management of visitors down there seems like it would be a good thing. Is there anything that you would keep?
You know, I think some of the cultural impacts, you know, or a cultural center or something else is not a bad idea. And assuming the cultural center is going to welcome visitors to come visit, I think the location of the cultural center, because right now they're talking about putting the cultural center right next to the boat dock, which means to get to the cultural center, you have to walk across the launch ramp, you know, the queue where all the boats line up to launch. And so when you're funneling guests to walk across the launch ramp, you're adding guests. And even if the cultural center only has a fraction of the number of visitors, say, for example, you see at the City of Refuge, you're talking about a lot of people being tucked into that mix. I would think it would make more sense to put the cultural center where they're talking about putting the commercial retail buildings and creating adequate parking there for it. So that way you don't have people traversing across the boat ramp to and from. I think that makes more sense. So I think some of that stuff is good. I would like to see in the plan how they're going to actually maintain the cultural stuff, because currently that path area has been in pretty poor condition for a number of years and not been managed. Like the benches have been rotten where you can't sit on them for years. And there's usually trash around there and other stuff. And so if they're going to do a cultural center or do cultural stuff, they need to make sure there's some plan in place to actually maintain it. So there has to be some way to make sure they fulfill their promise.
I know that you have many years of experience when it comes to EISs. I know that you've helped prepare them. You've also litigated cases involving them. At this point in time, what should be the next step? If the community submits comments and expresses their thoughts and their feelings, what then should KS do with those comments? What would be their next step in the process of this proposal?
Well, I think, A, there could be some studies that are done that would better inform, you know, the public and the regulatory agencies about the impacts. I would like them to also consider maybe a smaller scale project that maybe doesn't have, you know, it's not a bigger resort, and moving cultural center to try to actually pull congestion away from, you know, to the extent you have congestion, it's usually right around the boat ramp, because there's just those boats going in and out all day long. If there's any area that's congested, it's right on top of the boat ramp. So maybe create a plan that you would somehow be able to pull people away from that area and reduce that congestion. I mean, it's not a huge issue now, but I know I've heard some of the boat guys that are launching, they get frustrated because they have to wait in line and it can get backed up at times. So you've got to go either super early or whatever, because there's certain times the boat ramps just got a long queue. I'd like to see a plan that's maybe more limited in scope. And I'd like to see studies of what a more limited scope plan would be and the impact. I'd like to see an actual real maintenance plan, because they admit they haven't been doing maintenance on their property around the bay. I'd like to see a maintenance plan that's enforceable. That would be a condition of the project approval, where they would say, okay, we will guarantee to do this maintenance, and this would be a condition of our approval. So the county can come back and force them to do it in the future if they don't do the maintenance. I'd like to see, for example, the volleyball courts. There was two there for decades. You see both courts put back, and then the drainage issues that have been in the past corrected so they don't washed out during heavy rainfall. So I'd like to see that drainage fixed. So I'd like to see some of those things. I think would be really positive. It'd be a good way to outreach to community. I think they get a lot more support with maybe, you know, an outreach to the community in that respect. You know, hey, we'll do a little, you know, we'll offer to scale back our project. We'll actually pull congestion away. We're going to tell you how we're going to reduce the congestion around the boat ramp area. And we're going to do this, that, and this is how people are going to flow. And this is where people are going to have to walk to and from, and how that's going to work. And also tell us, for example, how many vehicles per day are going to be increased in the local area, so that we understand this is going to create X number, 300 vehicles a day, 400 vehicles a day. This is where people are going to park. This is where they're going to get to and from. This is how we're going to manage the traffic. Those are the kind of things that typically in an EIS format that they really drill down on. And usually in a project like this, that's one of the biggest focuses.
Jeff, those were all the questions that I had for you this morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. And, you know, I'm hoping that we can help Kamehameha Schools. You know, my comments are geared towards this is what we kind of need to do to be responsible stewards of the environment and of the bay, and to ensure not only the long-term health of the water and the flora and fauna within the bay, but also that the public's use and the local use of the bay is protected and make the project enhance that and offer more than taking away things that the public has cherished for many, many years.
That was retired environmental attorney Jeff Caulfield with his thoughts on the proposed Keauhou Bay Management Plan. The draft EIS is available for the public to read and comment on. Comments are due by August 7th. We'll have a link to the draft EIS on the conversation page of our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Kumu Kahua Theater's production of Ua Pau, an exploration of Hawaiian identity and family relationships, this Saturday and Sunday. Tickets at mauiarts.org.
The Bay Area chipmaker NVIDIA is continuing its expansion in more ways than one: bigger headquarters and a higher stock price.
We realized, wow, we have so much in our savings now from NVIDIA. It's grown so much, our stock has basically almost 10x.
I'm Kimberly Adams, NVIDIA in the economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters can expect to receive their primary election ballots by July 23rd. Elections.hawaii.gov.
Now it's time to cool off with the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the various types of shaved ice desserts found around the globe. Like snowflakes, no two are exactly alike. Hawaii shave ice originates from a similar dessert in Japan that's over 1,000 years old. It became more accessible in the 19th century when ice became more widely available to the public during the summertime. The first store selling this frozen treat is believed to have opened in Yokohama, Japan in 1869. Traditionally, it was made by spinning a block of ice over a shaving blade with a hand-powered crank, then adding a topping and creating a delectable dessert. We asked you to name this kind of shave ice. We were looking for kakigori. And fun fact, July 25th is Kakigori Day in Japan because on that day in 1933, there was a record high temperature. So grab some shave ice to pay homage to this classic dish. And kudos to our winner for today, Roger from Wahiwa. Congratulations, you won the tote bag. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that. Forget all the other concerns and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii has a long history of immigrants coming to our islands looking for a better life. And among the things that they bring with them is music. Musika Hibara is a specific kind of sound brought by Puerto Rican immigrants who arrived in the early 1900s. Here to talk more about it is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio.
Good morning, Russell. I really love that sound.
Yeah, Musika Hibara.
So Música Híbrida actually originated from the mountain regions of Puerto Rico. It was brought to the Caribbean island from settlers of Western Spain during the 17th century. And just about a week or two ago, I went to the first Puerto Rican festival here in Hawaii. And a lot of the Puerto Ricans that I've talked to during this festival, both are from Hawaii and even from the continental U.S., said it was such a treat to actually see these live performances here in the islands because it's so rare. And I spoke to Kelly Goto. She's Puerto Rican who lives on Oahu, who says like it's such a rare occasion for them to actually hear this genre in a live performance.
Híbrido is your old school. They're talking. They're telling you their story. And although I don't understand Spanish, you kind of comprehend because you see people laughing. The singer that's telling their story, they're laughing. They're imitating the burro, the donkey. They're imitating women. You know, this is what she said. And you don't have to understand the language to get the storytelling behind Híbrido. Híbrido is good stuff. And it's rare because it was the elders almost telling their story. Like, you know, I really liked her, but he wanted her too. And I really had to step up the game and show my macho-ness. You get that. Or it's like, you know, and the donkey and they'll make the burro noise. And it's the greatness. It's what you take away, your perception, but you get it.
I've heard a lot of Puerto Rican music in my lifetime, but I don't know that I've ever heard what Música Híbrida sounds like. Can we play a sample of the music? Sounds good.
There's a lot. Even like when I went to the Puerto Rican festival, you can actually really hear the band who plays Híbrido music. They really like sing from the heart. And depending on who you ask, the older generation will call it the hillbilly music from the mountain regions. But if you ask the younger generations, it's really their traditional folklore. So back in the day when if you're singing this type of genre, you actually are freestyling it. You're singing from the heart. Like what Kelly was saying, like let's say you got your heart broken, you're trying to win this woman's heart over. You'd actually sing how you're going to win her heart or how you're going to prove your love to her. But now like it's evolved over the years. And so Puerto Ricans who are playing this genre, they've really developed it into actually writing their own songs and recording music. And just like how we were hearing right now, you're hearing all these types of instruments. You're hearing congo, bonga, guiro, maracas, cuatro, bass, and guitar. But back in the day, it was just guiro, cuatro, and guitar. And one fun fact that I learned about the cuatro, which is the national instrument of Puerto Rico, is that it used to be 4 strings, but now it's 10 strings.
Wow.
But they still call it cuatro. So they never really changed the name. But Puerto Ricans, they have such a long history here in Hawaii. They came in the year 1900, a year or two after 2 hurricanes devastated their island, killing nearly 3,000 people and devastating the island's agriculture. But when they came to Hawaii, they came to work in the sugarcane plantations. And when they moved to Hawaii, they brought their culture with them. And I spoke with Carlos Arginzoni Hill, who is in a band that plays Híbrido music. And he's actually one of 2 bands in the entire state that plays this kind of genre. And he said he's trying so hard to preserve the genre from dying out.
Well, a lot of the kids that they were not interested in learning. And some of them, the parents didn't teach them, they didn't know how to play either. Or they faded away. So the older people got older and older, and they were not able to teach. So basically, you don't see too many kids playing this at all, actually. Not at all. So I'm trying to keep it going here. That's my duty, you know. I want to keep it going. I don't want to die.
And that's where he comes in, and he actually wants to teach more of the younger generation to play guitar. But the issue of teaching this genre is that earlier, when Puerto Ricans came to Hawaii, when they went to school, they were forbidden to speak Spanish, which is their local tongue. So you see much of the older generation who speaks Spanish, you can sing this type of music, as opposed to the younger generation like Kelly Goto, who was never taught how to speak Spanish.
And so I've heard you say Híbrido as well. So Música Híbrida, Música Híbrido, both are correct?
Both are correct. So Híbrido, from what Carlos has told me, is that's more like the English version. But Música Híbrida is the proper noun.
Okay. All right. Well, Cassie Ordonio, thanks so much for for giving us a cool lesson on Puerto Rican music. Really appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio about a rare Puerto Rican music tradition that has taken root here in Hawaii. And here's some more of that great musica jibara. And that's it for today. Tomorrow we have a call-in show about artificial intelligence, the good, the bad, and the useful. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call our TalkBack line at 808-792-8217 or send us an email, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find past interviews from The Conversation on our website. You can also listen to our show as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, and all other major podcast platforms. I'm Russell Subiono. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.